Mercy on them all. 58. Burj Al Arab Hotel, Dubai. The lanky Russian presented himself at reception 30 seconds later. He had a fine-boned, bloodless face and eyes the color of glacial ice. His American passport identified him as Anthony Colvin, as did his American Express card. He drummed his fingers on the countertop while waiting for the pretty Filipina to find his reservation. He was holding a mobile phone to his ear as though his life depended on it.
"Here we are," sang the Filipina. "We have you in a one-bedroom deluxe suite on the 29th floor for 3 nights. Is that correct, Mr. Colvin?"
"If you wouldn't mind," he said, lowering the mobile phone, "I'm looking for something on the 14th floor."
"The 29th is considered more desirable."
"My wife and I spent our honeymoon on the 14th. We'd like to stay there again. For sentimental reasons," he added. "Surely you understand." She didn't. The Filipino worked 12-hour shifts and shared a one-room apartment in Dera with 8 other girls. Her love life consisted of fending off drunken gropers and rapists who assumed wrongly that she moonlighted in Dubai's thriving sex trade. She clicked a few keys on her computer terminal and gave a plastic smile.
"Actually," she said, "we do have a number of rooms available on the 14th floor. Do you recall the room where you and your wife stayed on your honeymoon?"
"I believe it was 1437, he said. She appeared crestfallen.
"Unfortunately, that room is currently occupied, Mr. Colvin. However, the suite next to it is available, as is the one directly across the hall."
"I'll take the one across the hall, please."
"It's a bit more expensive."
"No problem," said the Russian.
"I'll need to see your wife's passport."
"She's joining me tomorrow."
"Please ask her to stop by when she arrives."
"First thing,"
he assured her. "Do you require assistance with your luggage?"
"I can manage, thanks."
She gave him a pair of electronic room keys and pointed him toward the appropriate elevator. As promised, his room was directly across the hall from 1437.
Entering, he immediately switched on the Do Not Disturb light and double-locked the door. Then he opened his suitcase. Inside were a few articles of clothing that stank of chickpeas and cumin.
There was also a Beretta 9mm, a Glock 45, 2 hypodermic needles, 2 vials of succinylmethonium chloride, a notebook computer, and an adjustable high-resolution snake camera.
He mounted the camera to the bottom of the door and connected its wiring to the computer. After adjusting the angle of the view, he filled the hypodermic needles with succinylmethonium chloride and the guns with bullets. Then he settled in before the computer and waited.
For the next 45 minutes he was treated to a view of the Burj Al Arab not seen on its website or in its glossy brochures. Frantic room service waiters, weary chambermaids, an Ethiopian nanny holding the hand of a hysterical child, an Australian businessman walking arm in arm with a Ukrainian prostitute. Finally, at 10 sharp, he saw a beautiful Arab woman stepping from room 1437 with a vigilant bodyguard at her back. When the woman and bodyguard were gone, a broad-shouldered man leaned out the doorway and looked both ways along the corridor. White kandura and kutra, tinted eyeglasses rimmed in gold, a neatly trimmed beard with flecks of grey round the chin. The Russian picked up the Glock, the man-stopper, and quietly chambered around.
59. Burj Al Arab Hotel, Dubai. The details of Nadia al-Bakari's departure from the Burj Al Arab were handled not by Gabriel and his team, but by Mansour, the chief of AAB's travel department. There were no belongings for her to collect, because Mansour had seen to them personally, nor were there any bills to pay, because they had already been forwarded to AAB headquarters in Paris. All Nadia had to do was make her way to the Burj's circular drive, where her car waited just outside the front entrance. After climbing into the back seat, she asked her driver and Rafiq al-Kamal to give her a moment of privacy. Alone, she dialed a number that had been stored in the memory of her BlackBerry. Gabriel answered immediately in Arabic.
"Tell me what he looked like."
"White kandura, white kutra, tinted eyeglasses with gold rims, a neatly trimmed beard with a bit of grey."
"You did well, Nadia. Go to the airport. Go home."
"Wait," she snapped. "There's something else I need to tell you."
Though Nadia did not know it, Gabriel was seated in the lobby, looking like a man who had come to Dubai for work rather than pleasure, which was indeed the case. On the table before him was a notebook computer. Attached to his ear was a hands-free mobile phone that doubled as a secure radio.
He used it to alert his far-flung team that the operation had just hit its first snag. Nadia tapped her BlackBerry on the window and signalled that she was ready to leave. A few seconds later, as they were speeding over the causeway separating the Burj from the mainland, Rafiq al-Kamal asked,
"Is there anything I need to know?"
"That meeting never happened."
"What meeting?" asked the bodyguard.
Nadia managed a smile. "Tell Mansour we're on our way to the airport. Tell him to move up our departure slot if he can. I'd like to get back to Paris at a reasonable hour."
Al-Kamal pulled out his phone and dialed.
"Maybe Allah really is on his side after all," said Adrian Carter.
He was staring in disbelief at Gabriel's latest transmission from Dubai. It said that Malik al-Zubair, Master of Terror, was about to walk out of the Burj Al Arab, surrounded by 4 carbon copies.
"I'm afraid God has very little to do with this," said Navot. "Malik has been matching wits against the best intelligence service in the world for years. He knows how the game is played."
Navot looked at Shamron, who was twirling his old Zippo lighter nervously between his fingers, 2 turns to the right, 2 turns to the left.
"We have 4 vehicles outside that hotel," Navot said. "Under our operating rules, that's enough to follow 1 car. 2 at most. If 5 similarly dressed men get into 5 different cars..."
His voice trailed off.
"We might want to start thinking about getting them out of there, boss." "We've gone to a great deal of effort to put a team on the ground in Dubai tonight, Uzi. The least we can do is let them stick around long enough to try to have a look at Malik's face."
He glanced at the row of clocks glowing along one of Rashidistan's walls, and asked,
"What is the status of Nadia's airplane?" "Fueled and ready for takeoff. The rest of her staff is boarding now." "And where is the star of the show at this moment?"
"Heading northeast on Sheikh Zayed Road at 46 miles per hour."
"May I see her?"
Carter snatched up a phone. A few seconds later, a winking red light appeared on one of the wall monitors, moving northeast across the grid of Dubai City. Shamron twirled his lighter anxiously as he watched its steady progress. 2 turns to the right, 2 turns to the left. The first Range Rover eased into the drive of the Burj Al Arab 2 minutes after Nadia's departure. A second appeared soon after, followed by a Mercedes GL and a pair of Denalis. Gabriel keyed into his secure radio, but Mikhail was on the air first.
"They're leaving the room," he said.
Gabriel didn't have to ask how many. The answer was outside in the drive. 5 SUVs for 5 men. Gabriel had to establish which of the 5 was Malik before any of the men set foot outside the hotel, and there was only one way to do it. He gave the order.
"There are 5 of them and 1 of me," Mikhail replied. "The longer you talk, the greater the chances we'll lose him."
Mikhail keyed out without another word. Gabriel glanced down at his laptop to check Nadia's location. She was halfway to the airport. Mikhail secured the room and stepped into the corridor. The Glock was now at the small of his back, with the suppressor screwed into place. The loaded syringe was in the outside pocket of his coat. He glanced to his right and saw the 5 men in white kanduras and gutras stepping around a corner into the elevator vestibule. He walked normally for a few seconds, but quickened his pace after hearing the chime indicating that a carriage had arrived. By the time he reached the vestibule, the 5 men had entered the elevator and the gleaming gold doors were beginning to close. He shouldered his way inside, mumbling an apology, and stood at the front of the carriage as the doors closed for a second time. In the reflection, he could see 5 matching men. 5 matching beards flecked with grey. 5 pairs of matching eyeglasses rimmed in gold. 5 prayer scars that looked recently irritated. There was just one difference. 4 of the men were staring directly at Mikhail. The 5th seemed to be looking down at his shoes. Malik. 22 floors above, Samir Abbas, fundraiser for the global jihadist movement, was catching up on a bit of legitimate work for Transarabian Bank when he heard a knock at the door. He had been expecting it. The Egyptian had said he would send someone when the meeting with Nadia was over. As it turned out, he sent not one man, but 2. They were dressed like Emiratis, but their accents betrayed them as Jordanians. Abbas admitted them without hesitation.
"The meeting went well?" he asked.
"Very well," said the older of the 2 men. "Miss Al-Bakari has agreed to make another donation to our cause. We have a few details we need to discuss with you."
Abbas turned to lead them into the seating area. Only when he felt the garrote biting into his neck did he realize his mistake. Unable to draw a breath or utter a sound, Abbas clawed desperately at the thin metal wire carving into his skin. The lack of oxygen quickly sapped his strength, and he was able to offer only token resistance as the men pushed him face down to the floor. It was then Abbas felt something else carving into his neck, and he realized they intended to take his head. It was punishment for infidels and apostates and the enemies of jihad. Samir Abbas was none of those things. He was a believer, a secret soldier in the army of Allah. But in a moment, for reasons he did not understand, he would be a shaheed. Mercifully, Abbas began to lose consciousness. He thought of the money he had hidden in the pantry of his flat in Zurich, and he hoped that Johara or the children might one day find it. Then he forced himself to go still and to submit to the will of God. The knife made a few more vicious strokes. Abbas saw a burst of brilliant white light and assumed it was the light of paradise. Then the light was extinguished, and there was nothing at all. 60. Burj Al Arab Hotel, Dubai. The elevator stopped twice before reaching the lobby. A sunburned British woman boarded on the 11th floor, a Chinese businessman on the 7th. The new arrivals forced Mikhail to retreat deeper into the carriage. He was now standing so close to Malik he could smell the coffee on his breath. The Glock was pressed reassuringly against Mikhail's spine, but it was the syringe in his coat pocket that occupied his thoughts. He was tempted to shove the needle into Malik's thigh. Instead, he stared at the ceiling or at his watch or at the numbers flashing on the display panel, anywhere but at the face of the murderer standing next to him. When the doors finally opened a third time, he followed the British woman and the Chinese businessman toward the bar. "He's the second one from the left," he said into his phone. "Are you sure?" "Sure enough to hit him right now if you tell me to."
"Not here."
"Don't let him leave. Do it now while we have a chance."
Gabriel went off the air. Mikhail entered the bar, counted slowly to 10, and walked out. Gabriel was packing up his laptop and conducting a false telephone conversation in rapid French as Malik and his four comrades came floating through the abbey in their white robes. Outside they engaged in a swirl of handshakes and formal kisses before making their way separately toward the SUVs. Despite the final element of physical deception, Gabriel had no problem tracking Malik as he climbed into the back of one of the Denalis. When the five cars were gone, a pair of Toyota Land Cruisers took their place. Mikhail managed to look vaguely bored as he slipped past the valet and climbed into the front passenger seat of the first. Gabriel entered the second.
"Put on your seat belt," Chiara said as she accelerated away. "These people drive like maniacs."
The news that Malik was under office surveillance reached Rashidistan at 10:12 p.m. Dubai time. It provoked a brief outburst of emotion among the skeleton crew, but not among the three spymasters gathered around the pod in the center of the room. Shamron seemed particularly aggrieved as he watched the winking red light making its way along Sheikh Zayed Road.
"It occurs to me that we haven't heard from our friend Samir Abbas in some time," he said, eyes still on the wall monitor. "Would it be possible to call his mobile phone from a number he would recognize?"
"Anyone in particular?" asked Carter.
"Make it his wife," Shamron said. "Samir always struck me as the family type."
"You just referred to him in the past tense."
"Did I?"
Shamron asked absently.
Carter looked at one of the techs and said, "Make it happen."
The residents of Dubai are not only among the richest people in the world, but they are also statistically some of its worst drivers. A collision, be it with another car, pedestrian, or object, occurs every 2 minutes in the emirate, resulting in 3 fatalities a day on average. The typical driver thinks nothing of slashing across multiple lanes of heavy traffic or tailgating at 100 miles per hour while talking on his cell phone. As a result, few people took notice of the high-speed chase that occurred shortly after 10 p.m. on the road to Jebel Ali. It was just another night at the races. The road had 4 lanes in each direction, with a grassy median down the center, and traffic signals that most locals dismissed as unwanted advice. Gabriel clung to the armrest as Chiara ably manoeuvred the big land cruiser through the herd of other vehicles just like it. Because it was a Thursday evening, the beginning of the weekend in the Islamic world, the traffic was heavier than on a typical night. Enormous sport utility vehicles were the norm, rather than the exception. Most were driven by bearded men wearing white kanduras and kutras. The five cars of Malik's motorcade were engaged in something like a rolling shell game. They weaved, they swerved, they flashed their high beams for slower traffic to give way, all perfectly appropriate conduct on the anarchic roads of Dubai. Chiara and the three other drivers of the chase team did their best to maintain contact. It was a perilous business. Despite the lawlessness of the roads, the Emirati police didn't look kindly upon foreigners who got into accidents. Malik knew this, of course. Gabriel wondered what else Malik knew. He was beginning to worry that the elaborate security measures were more than simply precautions, that Malik, as usual, was one step ahead of his enemies. They were approaching the port of Jebel Ali. They shot past the glittering Ibn Battuta theme park and shopping mall, then a desalinization plant. Dubai in a snapshot. Gabriel scarcely noticed the landmarks. He was watching the carefully choreographed manoeuvre occurring on the road directly ahead. Four of the SUVs were now side by side across the four lanes of traffic. They had reduced their speed and were engaged in a blocking tactic. The fifth, the Denali in which Malik was riding, was accelerating rapidly.
"He's getting away, Chiara. You have to get past them."
"Where?"
"Find a way."
Chiara swerved hard to the left, then to the right. Each time an SUV blocked the way.
"Force your way between them."
"Gabriel,
do it."
She tried. There was no way through. They were nearing the end of the Jebel Ali free zone. Beyond it lay the expanse of desert separating Dubai from the Emirate of Abu Dhabi. Gabriel could no longer see Malik's Denali. It was but a distant star in a galaxy of other tail lights. Directly ahead, a spotlight switched from green to amber. The four SUVs slowed instantly, surely a first in Dubai, and came to a stop. As car horns began to sound, one of Malik replicas stepped out and stared at Gabriel for a long moment, before dragging his thumb knife-like across his own throat. Gabriel took a quick radio roll call of the team and determined all was safe and accounted for. Then he dialed Nadia's BlackBerry. There was no answer. 61. Dubai. The Boeing business jet owned and operated by AAB Holdings departed Dubai International Airport at 10:40 that evening. All available evidence suggested that Nadia Al-Bakari, the company's chairwoman, was not on board at the time. Her BlackBerry had gone off the air at 10:14 p.m. as her car was crossing Dubai Creek, and was no longer emitting a signal of any kind. In the moments preceding the break, she had been chatting amiably with Rafiq Al-Kamal. The last audio captured by the device was a muffled thumping that could have been anything from a death struggle to the sound of Nadia tapping her forefinger on the screen, something she often did while riding in cars. The transmitters hidden in her handbag and clothing were, at the moment of the disruption, far beyond the range of the listening posts inside the Burj Al Arab, and therefore provided no clues as to what had transpired. Only the GPS beacons remained functional. Eventually, they ceased moving at an empty lot along the Dubai Hatta Road, not far from the Polo Club. Gabriel found the Chanel suit at 10:53 p.m., and the watch a few minutes later. He carried the items over to the Land Cruiser and examined them in the light of the dash. The fabric of the suit was torn in several places, and there were bloodstains on the collar. The crystal of the watch was smashed, though the inscription on the back remained clearly legible. "To the future, Thomas." He told Chiara to start back to the hotel, then sent a message to Langley on his BlackBerry. The reply came 2 minutes later. Gabriel swore softly as he read it.
"What does it say?"
"They want us to leave for the airport immediately."
"What about Nadia?"
"There is no Nadia," Gabriel said, slipping the BlackBerry into his coat pocket. "Not as far as Langley and Shamron are concerned."
"Not any more."
"So we leave her behind?"
asked Chiara angrily, her eyes on the road.
"Is that what they want us to do? Use her money and her name and then throw her to the wolves? Do you know what they're going to do to her?"
"They're going to kill her," Gabriel said. "And she won't be given the courtesy of a decent death. That's not the way they conduct their business."
"Maybe she's already dead,"
Chiara said.
Maybe that's what Malik's friend was trying to tell you.
She might be, Gabriel conceded. But I doubt it. They wouldn't have bothered to remove her clothing and her jewelry if they intended to kill her quickly. It suggests they wanted to have a word with her in private, which is understandable. After all, they lost their network because of her.
Gabriel's BlackBerry chimed a second time. It was Langley again asking for confirmation he had received the message to abort. Gabriel ignored it and stared sullenly out the window at the lights of the financial district.
"Is there anything we can do for her?"
asked Chiara.
"I suppose that depends entirely on Malik."
"Malik is a monster, and you can be sure he knows you're here in Dubai."
"Even monsters can be reasoned with."
"Not jihadists. They're beyond reason."
She drove in silence for a moment, with one hand on the wheel and the other clutching the fabric of Nadia's blood-stained suit.
"I know you made her a promise," she said finally. "But you made a promise to me, too."
"Should I let her die, Chiara?"
"God, no!"
"What do you want me to do?"
"Why do I have to make this decision?"
"Because you're the only one who can."
Chiara was wrenching at the fabric of Nadia's suit, tears streaming down her cheeks. Gabriel asked whether she wanted him to drive. She seemed not to hear him. Gabriel's message flashed across the screens of Rashidistan 30 seconds later. Shamron stared at it in consternation. Then he lit a cigarette in violation of Langley's draconian no-smoking policy and said,
"Now might be a good time to put some birds in the air and boots on the ground."
Carter and Navot responded by reaching simultaneously for their phones. Within a few minutes, the birds were taking off from a secret CIA installation in Bahrain, and the boots were headed silently across the black waters of the Gulf toward the beach at Jebel Ali. By the time Gabriel and Chiara returned to the hotel, the rest of the team had already engaged in a hasty but methodical evacuation. It had commenced upon receipt of Shamron's order and was being conducted under the auspices of one Thomas Fowler, newly minted partner in the venture capital firm of Rogers and Cressy. The hotel's management had been led to believe the sudden checkout was the result of a health emergency suffered by one of Mr. Fowler's employees. The fixed base operator at Dubai International Airport had been told the same story. It was preparing Mr. Fowler's private aircraft for a 2 a.m. departure. The crew had been told to anticipate no delays. Despite the urgency of the situation, the team managed to maintain strict operational discipline inside the hotel. In rooms they assumed to be bugged, they referred to one another by false names, and spoke mainly of business and finance. Only their stricken expressions betrayed the anguish they were all feeling, and only when they were beneath the protective shroud of the khuppa did they dare to speak the truth. Shielded from the ruler's listening devices, Gabriel conducted a tense call with Shamron and Navot at Rashidistan. He also spoke face-to-face with the members of his team. Most of the encounters were business-like, a few were confrontational. Chiara came to him last. Alone, she reminded him of the afternoon they had made love in the safe house by Lake Zurich, when her body had burned as if from fever. Then she kissed his lips one final time, before collecting her luggage and heading to the lobby. Shamron had always believed careers were defined less by the successes achieved than the calamities survived.
"Any fool can take a victory lap," he once famously remarked during a lecture at the academy. "But only a truly great officer can maintain his composure and his cover when his heart is breaking."
If that were indeed the case, Shamron would have witnessed the very definition of greatness that night as Gabriel's fabled team filed out of the Burj Al Arab and set off for the airport. Only Chiara appeared distraught, in part because her heart truly was breaking, but also because she had volunteered to play the role of the seriously ill employee. Management wished her well as they helped her into the back of a hotel limousine. Mr. Fowler tipped the valets lavishly before climbing in after her. They followed the same route Nadia had taken earlier that evening, but arrived at the airport without incident. After a cursory check of their passports, they chose to board the aircraft immediately rather than wait in the luxuriously appointed VIP lounge. A cancellation allowed them to depart earlier than expected, and by 1:30 they were rising over the blackness of the empty quarter. Two members of the team were not on board. Mikhail was headed toward an isolated beach west of Jebel Ali. Gabriel to the old quarter of Dubai known as Dera. After leaving his Toyota Land Cruiser along the Corniche, he walked to the shabby little apartment house near the gold souk and climbed the staircase that stank of chickpeas and cumin. Alone in the apartment, he sat at the peeling kitchen table, staring at the screen of his BlackBerry. To help pass the time, he replayed the operation in his mind. Somewhere along the line there had been a leak, or an act of betrayal. He was going to find the person responsible, and then he was going to kill him. It was another 20 minutes before Mikhail heard the crackle of a voice in his earpiece. It spoke a word or two, no more. Even so, he recognized it. He had heard it many times before. In the hellholes of Gaza, in the hills of southern Lebanon, in the alleyways of Jericho and Nablus and Hebron. He flashed his headlights twice, briefly illuminating the chalky white beach, and drummed his fingers anxiously on the steering wheel as a blacked-out Zodiac bobbed ashore. Four men slipped out, each carrying nylon gear bags. They looked like Arabs. They moved like Arabs. They even wore cologne that made them smell like Arabs. But they were not Arabs. They were members of the elite Sayeret Matkal. And one of them, Yoav Savir, was Mikhail's former commanding officer.
"Long time no see," Yoav said as he climbed into the front passenger seat. "What happened?"
"We lost someone very important."
"What's his name?"
"Her," said Mikhail. "Her name is Nadia."
"Who's got her?"
"Malik."
"Which Malik?"
"The only Malik that matters."
"Shit!"
The lights of the giant Sheba oil drilling facility glowed like neon green embers on the wall monitors of Rashidistan. The image was being transmitted live by an unmanned Predator drone, now under the control of a crew at Langley. At Carter's direction, the aircraft banked eastward over the string of oases along the Saudi Emirates border, then followed the main highway back toward Dubai City, its night vision and thermal imaging cameras searching the desert floor for any sign of life, but ordinarily there was none. As the Predator approached the port of Jebel Ali, its cameras settled briefly on a small Zodiac heading back out to sea, a single figure aglow in the stern. No one in Rashidistan paid much attention to the image, because they were monitoring a conversation on Gabriel's BlackBerry. The computers recognized the number of the caller. They also recognized his voice. It was Malik al-Zubair, the only Malik that mattered. 62. Deira, Dubai.
"I'm surprised you answered. Perhaps it's true what they say about you."
"What's that, Malik?"
"That you are courageous, that you are a man of your word. Personally, I remain skeptical. I've never met a Jew who was not a coward and alive."
"I never realized Zarqa had such a large Jewish community."
"Thankfully, there are no Jews in Zarqa, only victims of the Jews."
"Where is she, Malik?"
"Who?"
"Nadia," said Gabriel.
"What have you done with her?" "Why would you assume we have her?"
"Because there's only one place where you could have gotten this telephone number."
"Clever Jew."
"Let her go."
"You're not in a position to make demands at the moment."
"I'm not demanding anything," Gabriel said calmly. "I'm asking you to let her go."
"As a humanitarian gesture?"
"Call it whatever you like. Just do the decent thing."
"You murdered her father in front of her, and you're asking me to do the decent thing?"
"What do you want, Malik?"
"We demand that you release all the brothers who were arrested by the Americans and their allies after your little deception. In addition, we demand that you free the brothers being held illegally at Guantanamo Bay."
"No Palestinian prisoners? You disappoint me."
"I wouldn't want to interfere with the ongoing negotiations between you and the brothers of Hamas."
"Ask for something reasonable, Malik, something I can actually give you."
"We never negotiate with terrorists. Release our brothers, and we will release your spy with no further harm."
"What have you done to her?"
"I can assure you it was nothing compared to the pain suffered by our brothers each and every day in the torture chambers of Cairo and Amman and Riyadh."
"Haven't you been reading the papers, Malik?
The Arab world is changing. Pharaoh is gone. The House of Saud is cracking. The little Hashemite king of Jordan is frightened for his life. The decent people of the Arab world have achieved in a matter of months
what Al-Qaeda and its ilk couldn't accomplish with years of senseless slaughter. Your time has passed, Malik. The Arab world doesn't want you. Let her go.
I'm afraid I can't do that alone.
He paused for a moment, as if pondering a way out of the impasse he had created.
But there is one other possibility.
Gabriel listened to Malik's instructions. So did Shamron, Navot, and Adrian Carter.
What happens if we don't accept? Gabriel asked.
Then she will suffer the traditional punishment for apostasy. But don't worry. You'll be able to watch her death on the Internet. The Yemeni plans to use it as a recruiting device to replace all the operatives we lost because of her.
I need proof she's still alive.
I'm afraid you'll just have to trust me, Malik said.
And then the line went dead. Gabriel's BlackBerry rang a few seconds later. It was Adrian Carter.
He's definitely still in the Emirates.
Where?
NSA hasn't been able to triangulate it yet, but they think he might be out in the western desert, near the Liwa Oasis. We have a bird over the area now, and two more headed that way.
Gabriel removed a small device from an internal pouch of his overnight bag. It was about the size of an average antibiotic tablet. On one side was a miniature metallic switch. He flipped it, then asked,
"Can you see the signal?"
"Got it,"
said Carter.
Gabriel swallowed the device.
"Can you still see it?"
"Got it."
"The fish souk. 10 minutes.
"Got it."
Gabriel was still wearing the business attire of his cover identity. He briefly considered changing into something more appropriate for a night in the desert, but realized that wouldn't be necessary. His captors would surely do that for him. He placed his wristwatch in his bag along with his BlackBerry, wallet, passport, weapon, and a few meaningless scraps of pocket litter. He was no longer in possession of syringes or succinylcholine chloride, only Advil and anti-diarrhea medicine. He took enough Advil to temporarily dull the pain of any injuries he might suffer in the next few hours, and enough of the anti-diarrhea medicine to turn his bowels to concrete for a month. Then he locked the bag in the closet and headed downstairs to the street. 6 minutes remained for Gabriel to make the short walk to the fish souk. It was located near the mouth of Dubai Creek along the Corniche. Despite the late hour, there were groups of young men taking the night air along the waterfront, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Filipinos, and four Arabs who were not Arabs at all. Gabriel stood next to a street lamp to make himself clearly visible, and within a few seconds a Denali SUV stopped directly in front of him. Behind the wheel was one of the Malik clones. Another was seated in the back. So was Rafiq al-Kamal, Nadia al-Bakari's former chief of security. It was al-Kamal who gestured for Gabriel to climb in, and al-Kamal 30 seconds later who delivered the first blow, an elbow to Gabriel's chest that nearly stopped his heart. Then they forced him to the floor and pummeled him until there was no strength left in their arms. The harvest was over, thought Gabriel, as he slipped into unconsciousness. Now it was time for the feast. 63. The Empty Quarter, Saudi Arabia. The maps refer to it ominously as the Rub al-Khali, literally the Quarter of Emptiness. The Bedouin, however, know it by another name. They call it the Sands. Covering an area the size of France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, it stretches from Oman and the Emirates across Saudi Arabia and into portions of Yemen. Dunes, the size of mountains, roam the desert floor in the relentless wind. Some stand alone, others link themselves into chains that meander for hundreds of miles. In summer, the temperature routinely exceeds 140 degrees, cooling to 100 degrees at night. There is almost no rain, little in the way of plant or animal life, and few people other than the Bedouin and the bandits and the terrorists from Al-Qaeda who move freely across the borders. Time matters little in the sands. Even now it is measured in the length of the walk to the next well. Like most Saudis, Nadia al-Bakari had never set foot in the empty quarter. That changed 3 hours after her abduction, though Nadia was unaware of it. Having been injected with the general anesthetic ketamine, she believed herself to be wandering lost through the gilded rooms of her youth. Her father appeared to her briefly. He wore the traditional robes of a Bedouin and the angry face known as the Juhayman. His body had been pierced by bullets. He made her touch his wounds, then chided her for conspiring with the very men who had inflicted them. She would have to be punished, he said, just as Reyna had been punished for bringing dishonor upon her family. It was the will of God. There was nothing to be done. It was at the instant her father condemned her to death that Nadia felt herself beginning to float upward through the layers of consciousness. It was a slow rise, like a diver ascending from a great depth. When she finally reached the surface, she forced her eyes open and drew an enormous breath. Then she took stock of her surroundings. She was lying on her side on a rug that smelled of male body odor and camel. Bound at the wrists, she was cloaked in a thin garment of sheer white cotton. It was aglow with moonlight, as was the Salafi-style tobe of the man watching over her. He wore a takia skullcap with no headdress and carried an automatic weapon with a banana-shaped magazine. Even so, his eyes were unusually gentle for an Arab man. Then Nadia realized she had seen them before. They were the eyes of Ali, the Talib of Sheikh Marwan bin Taib.
"Where am I?" she asked.
He answered truthfully. It was not a good sign.
"How's Safiya?"
"She's well," the Talib said, smiling in spite of the situation.
"How long now until the baby comes?"
3 months, he said.
"Inshallah, it will be a boy."
"Actually, the doctors say we will have a girl."
"You don't sound displeased."
"I'm not."
"Have you chosen a name?"
"We're going to call her Hanan." In Arabic it meant mercy. Perhaps there was hope after all. The Talib began to recite verses of the Quran softly to himself. Nadia rolled onto her back and gazed up at the stars. They seemed close enough to touch. There was only the sound of the Quran and a distant hum of some sort. For a moment she assumed it was another hallucination caused by the drugs, or perhaps, she thought, by the abnormality in her brain. Then she closed her eyes, silencing the voice of the Talib, and listened intently. It was no hallucination, she concluded. It was an aircraft of some sort, and it was getting closer. A single narrow road links the Emirati oasis town of Liwa with the Sheba oil facility on the other side of the border in Saudi Arabia. Nadia had passed through the checkpoint as the sleeping, veiled wife of one of her captors. Gabriel was made to suffer the same indignity, though unlike Nadia, he was fully aware of what was happening. Beneath his veil he wore the blue coveralls of a Dubai labourer. They had been given to him in a produce warehouse in Al-Khazna, a desert town in the Emirate of Abu Dhabi, after he had been stripped of his own clothing and searched for beacons and listening devices. He had also been given a second beating, with Rafiq al-Kamal doing most of the heavy lifting. Gabriel supposed the Saudi had a right to be cross with him. After all, Gabriel had killed his old boss, and then recruited the boss's daughter as an agent. Al-Kamal's involvement in Nadia's abduction puzzled Gabriel. At whose behest, he wondered, was the Saudi here? The terrorists, or the al-Saud? For now it didn't matter. What mattered was keeping Nadia alive. It would require one last lie, one last deception. He conceived the lie on the road to Sheba while wearing the blue coveralls of a labourer and the black veil of a woman. Then he told it to himself again and again, until he believed every word of it to be true. On the giant plasma screens of Langley, Gabriel was but a smudge of winking green light making its way across the empty quarter. A cluster of 5 more lights blinked near the oasis town of Liwa. They represented the positions of Mikhail Abramov and the Sayeret Matkal team.
"There's no way they're going to get through that border checkpoint," said Carter.
"So they'll go around it," said Shamron.
"There's a fence along the entire border.
Fences mean nothing to the Sayeret."
"How are they going to get a land cruiser over it?"
"They have 2 land cruisers," said Shamron. "But I'm afraid neither one is going over that fence."
"What are you saying?"
"We wait until Gabriel stops moving."
"And then?"
"They walk."
"In the empty quarter?" Carter asked incredulously.
"That's what they're trained to do." What happens if they run into a Saudi military patrol?
Then I suppose we'll have to say Kaddish for the patrol, said Shamron. Because if they bump into Mikhail Abramov and Yoav Savir, they will cease to exist.
There was an all-night gas station and market in Liwa that catered for foreign laborers and truck drivers. The Indian behind the counter looked as though he hadn't slept in a month. Yoav, the Arab who was not an Arab, bought enough food and water for a small army, along with a few cheap gutras and some loose-fitting cotton clothing favored by Pakistanis and Bangladeshis. He told the Indian that he and his friends planned to spend a day or two in the dunes communing with God and nature. The night manager told him about a particularly inspiring formation north of Liwa, along the Saudi border.
But be careful, he said. The area is full of smugglers and Al-Qaeda. Very dangerous.
Yoav thanked the Indian for the warning. Then he paid the bill without haggling and headed outside to the land cruisers. They started northward, as the Indian had suggested, but once clear of the town made an abrupt turn to the south. The dunes were the colour of rose, and as high as the Judean hills. They drove for an hour, keeping always to the hard sand flats, before coming to a stop near the Saudi border fence. With dawn fast approaching, they covered the land cruisers in camouflage netting and changed into the clothing they had bought in Liwa. Yoav and the other Sayeret men looked like Arabs, but Mikhail looked like a Western explorer who had come in search of the lost city of Arabia. His expedition commenced 30 minutes later, when the green smudge of light that was Gabriel Alon finally stopped moving at a point 40 miles due west of the team's position. They loaded their packs with as much weaponry and water as they could carry. Then they scaled the Saudi border fence and started walking. 64. The Empty Quarter, Saudi Arabia. The tent had been erected in the cleft of an enormous horseshoe-shaped dune. It was made of black goat hair in the tradition of the Bedouin, and surrounded by several sun-bleached pickup trucks and jeeps. A few feet from the entrance, four veiled women with henna tattoos on their hands brewed coffee with cardamom seeds around a small fire. None seemed to notice the beaten man in blue coveralls, who stumbled from the back of a Denali SUV, shivering in the cold morning air. The cleft of the dune was still in darkness, but light glowed faintly above its ridgeline and the stars were in full retreat. Prodded by Al-Kamal, Gabriel started unsteadily toward the tent. His head throbbed, but his thoughts remained clear. They were focused on a lie. He would pay it out slowly, morsel by morsel, like cakes sweetened with honey. He would make himself irresistible to them. He would buy time for Mikhail and the Sayeret team to home in on the signal emanating from the device in his bowels. He pushed the beacon from his thoughts. There was no beacon, he reminded himself. There was only Nadia al-Bakari, a woman of impeccable jihadist credentials, whom Gabriel had blackmailed into doing his bidding. Malik was now standing in the opening of the tent. He had traded his gleaming white kandura for a grey tobe. His feet were bare, though his head was wrapped in a red checkered gutra. He regarded Gabriel menacingly, as though debating where to place the first blow, then stepped to one side. Al-Kamal responded by shoving Gabriel forcefully between the shoulder blades, propelling him headlong into the tent. The undignified nature of his arrival seemed to bring enormous pleasure to the men gathered inside. 8 in all, they were seated in a semicircle, drinking the cardamom-scented coffee from thimble-sized cups. A few wore the traditional curved jambiya daggers of Yemeni men, but one was peering into the screen of a notebook computer. His face was familiar to Gabriel, as was the sound of his voice when finally he spoke. It was the voice of a man to whom Allah had granted a beautiful and seductive tongue. It was the voice of Rashid. To the thermal imaging cameras of the Predator drone circling overhead, the gathering in the goat-hair Bedouin tent appeared as 11 amoeba-like orbs of light. Nearby there were several other human heat sources as well. There were four figures seated around a small fire. There was a ring of security posts scattered amid the dunes, and there were two figures about 1,000 yards from the tent's southern flank, one lying supine on the desert floor, the other seated cross-legged. As dawn slowly broke, Shamron asked Carter whether it might be possible to have a look at the two figures through a normal lens. Another 5 minutes would elapse until there was sufficient light, but when the image appeared on the screens of Langley, it was remarkably clear. It showed a raven-haired woman in white, being guarded by a bearded man holding what appeared to be an AK-47. A short distance away, on the other side of a large dune, a cylindrical hole had been dug in the desert floor. Next to the hole was a pile of stones. When the staff at Rasidistan regained its composure, Carter said,
"There's no way Mikhail and Sayeret team can get there in time. And even if they do, they're going to be spotted."
"Yes, Adrian," Shamron said.
"I realize that. Let me call Prince Nabil at the Interior Ministry."
"Why would you waste your time doing that?"
"Maybe he can do something to prevent them from being killed."
"Maybe," said Shamron.
"Or maybe this is all Nabil is doing."
"You think Nabil sold her out to Rashid and Malik?" "As far as Nabil is concerned, she's a heretic and a dissident. What better way to get rid of her than hand her over to the bearded ones to be executed?"
Carter swore softly. Shamron looked at the image from the desert.
"I take it the predators are fully armed?" he asked.
"Hellfire missiles," replied Carter.
"Have you ever fired one into Saudi Arabia?"
"Not a chance."
"I assume you would need clearance from the president before doing so."
"You assume correctly."
"Then please call him now, Adrian."
65. The Empty Quarter, Saudi Arabia. Rashid began with a lecture. He was part poet, part preacher, part professor of jihad. He warned that Israel would soon go the way of Pharaoh's regime in Egypt. He predicted Sharia was coming to Europe, whether Europe wanted it or not. He declared that the American century was finally over, alhamdulillah. It was one of the few Arabic expressions he used. The rest was delivered in his impeccable colloquial English. It was like being tutored in the principles of the Salaf by a kid from Best Buy. He spoke not to Gabriel, but to a digital camera mounted atop a tripod. Occasionally he wagged a long finger for emphasis, or pointed it toward his famous captive, who was seated a few feet away, squinting slightly in the glare of two standing lamps. Gabriel could only imagine how the heat blooms must have appeared to the predator drones overhead. He felt as though he was sitting in the jihadi version of a television studio, with Rashid playing the role of confrontational host. Malik, master of terror, was pacing slowly behind the cameras. That was the nature of their relationship, thought Gabriel. Rashid was the on-camera talent. Malik was the dogged producer who saw to the messy details. Rashid inspired, Malik maimed and murdered, all in the name of Allah. When Rashid finally concluded his opening monologue, he turned to the main portion of this morning's program, the interview. He began by asking Gabriel to state his name and place of residence. When Gabriel answered, "Roland Devereux, Quebec City, Canada," Rashid showed a flash of anger. There was a petulance to it that Gabriel might have found amusing if he were not surrounded by men with curved Jambia daggers. Rashid's ideas were monstrous, but in person he was oddly unthreatening. That's what Malik was for.
"Your real name," Rashid snapped. "Tell me the name you were given at your birth."
"You know my real name."
"Why don't you say it now?" asked Rashid. "Are you ashamed of it?"
"No," said Gabriel. "I just don't use it often."
"Say it now."
Gabriel did.
"Where were you born?"
"In the valley of Jezreel in the state of Israel."
"And where were your parents born?"
"Germany."
Rashid clearly saw this as proof of a great historical crime.
"Your parents were survivors of the so-called Holocaust?" he asked.
"No. They were survivors of the actual Holocaust."
"Are you employed by the intelligence service of the State of Israel?"
"Sometimes."
"Are you an assassin?"
"I have killed in the line of duty."
"You consider yourself a soldier?"
"Yes."
"You have killed many Palestinians?"
"Yes, many."
"Are you proud of your work?"
"No," Gabriel said.
"Then why do you do it?"
"Because of people like you."
"Our cause is just."
"Your cause is grotesque."
Rashid seemed suddenly rattled.
his exclusive was not going as planned. He guided it back onto firmer ground.
Where were you on the evening of August 24th, 2006?
I was in Cannes, Gabriel said without hesitation.
In France?
Yes, in France.
And what were you doing there?
I was supervising an operation.
What was the nature of this operation?
It was a targeted killing.
And who was the target?
Abdul Aziz al-Bakari.
Who ordered his assassination?
I don't know.
Rashid clearly did not believe him, but appeared unwilling to waste valuable airtime on ancient history.
Did you take part in his actual killing?
He asked. Yes.
Did you see Nadia al-Bakari that night?
Yes, I did.
When did you see her next?
In December.
Where?
At a chateau, north of Paris.
What transpired next?
What transpired, Sir Gabriel, was an elaborate operation to blackmail one of the richest women in the world into doing the bidding of Israeli and American intelligence. Through an informant, the CIA had learned that Rashid's nascent network was desperately in need of financial assistance. The agency wanted to provide the money to the network and then track it as it moved through the various cells and business fronts. There was only one problem. The money had to come from someone the terrorists trusted. The CIA asked Israeli intelligence whether it had any ideas. Israeli intelligence did. Her name was Nadia al-Bakari. An emissary of Israeli intelligence visited Miss al-Bakari in Paris under false pretenses, and made it clear that AAB Holdings would be destroyed if she didn't agree to cooperate.
How was the company to be harmed? Asked Rashid.
Through a campaign of well-orchestrated leaks to our friends in the media.
Jewish friends, of course.
Yes, of course.
What would have been the nature of these leaks?
That AAB Holdings was a jihadist enterprise, the way it had been under her father.
Go on.
Gabriel complied. For the camera, he adopted an expression of reticence. It was a lie, like the other lies that flowed from his swollen lips. He spun them slowly and in great detail. Rashid appeared to hang on every word.
"Your account is interesting," Rashid said, "but I'm afraid it contradicts what we've already been told by Miss al-Bakari. She says she willingly helped you."
"She was instructed to say that."
"You threatened her?"
"Constantly."
"Where did the money come from for the operation?"
"It was Nadia's."
"You forced her to use her own money?"
"That's correct."
"Why didn't you use government money?"
"Budgets are tight."
"You couldn't find a wealthy Jewish donor to fund the project?"
"It was too sensitive."
Rashid looked contemptuously at the camera, then at Gabriel.
"Miss al-Bakari visited Dubai yesterday," he said after a moment. "What was the purpose of the visit?"
"I believe she was there to conclude a major land and development deal."
"The real purpose, Alon?"
"We sent her there to identify a senior operative in your network."
"He was to be arrested?"
"No," said Gabriel.
"He was to be killed."
The cleric smiled. His guest had just made an important admission, one Rashid could use to generate headlines around the world.
"It strikes me that this episode is typical of the entire so-called war on terror. You cannot defeat us, Alon, and each time you try, you only make us stronger."
"You're not getting stronger," Gabriel countered. "In fact, you're dying. The Arab world is changing. Your time has passed."
Rashid's smile evaporated. He spoke with a tone of a stern teacher frustrated with a dull pupil.
"Surely, Alon, a man such as yourself is not so naive as to think this great Arab awakening is going to produce Western-style democracy in the Middle East. The revolt might have started with the students and the secularists, but the brothers will have the last word. We are the future. Regrettably, it is a future you will not be around to see. But before you leave this earth, I am obligated to ask you a final question. Do you wish to submit to the will of Islam and become a Muslim?"
"Only if it prevents you from killing Nadia."
"Unfortunately, that's not possible. Her crime is far worse than yours."
"Then I'll remain a Jew."
"So be it."
Rashid rose to his feet. Malik switched off the camera. The empty quarter was ablaze with light by the time the first figures emerged from the tent. There were 10 in all, 5 in white, 5 in black. They climbed quickly into the caravan of jeeps and pickup trucks and circled the encampment at high speed, collecting the security men. A moment later they were streaking southeast across the sands toward Yemen.
"How much do you want to bet that one of those bastards is Rashid?" Adrian Carter asked helplessly.
"All the more reason you should take the shot," said Nawalt.
"The White House won't allow it. Not on Saudi soil. And not without knowing exactly who's down there."
"They're terrorists, and friends of terrorists," Shamron said. "Take the shot."
"And what if one of them is Gabriel?"
"I'm afraid that's not possible," said Shamron.
"How can you be so certain?"
Shamron pointed wordlessly toward one of the screens.
"Are you sure it's him?" asked Carter.
"I'd recognize that walk anywhere."
66. The Empty Quarter, Saudi Arabia. The Talib walked along the base of a vast, star-shaped dune. He carried his automatic weapon in one hand and with the other led Nadia by the binding at her wrists. As they rounded the dune, she saw the hole that had been dug in the desert floor. Next to it was a pyramid of stones. In the razor-sharp sun they looked as white as exposed bone. Nadia tried to be brave, as she imagined Reina had been brave in the final moments before her death. Then she felt the desert began to spin, and she collapsed.
"It won't be as bad as you think," the Talib said, pulling her gently to her feet. "The first few will cause great pain. Then, inshallah, you will lose consciousness, and you won't feel a thing."
"Please," said Nadia, "you must find some way to spare me this."
"It is the will of God," said the Talib. "There is nothing to be done."
"It is not the will of God, Ali. It is the will of evil men."
"Walk," was all he said. "You have to walk."
"Would you do this to Safiya?"
"Walk."
"Would you, Ali?"
"If she violated the laws of God, I would have no choice."
"And what about Hanan? Would you stone your own child?"
This time the Talib said nothing. After a few paces, he began to recite verses of the Quran softly to himself, but to Nadia he spoke not another word. On the other side of the mountainous dune, Gabriel padded barefoot across the sand with Malik at his side. Four other men surrounded them. Three had been with Malik in Dubai. The fourth was Rafiq al-Kamal. The bodyguard had been assigned the task of carrying the knife that would be used for Gabriel's execution, and the video camera that would record it. Malik and the others carried automatic weapons. They were old Soviet-issue AK-47s, the kind you could buy for a few rials even in the most remote villages of Yemen. As Gabriel worked his wrists carefully against the silver duct tape, he tried to calculate the odds of getting his hands on one of the weapons. They were not good, he thought, but death by gunfire was surely better than death by beheading. If he were to die in the empty quarter on this morning, he planned to die on his own terms. And if possible, he was going to take Malik al-Zubair with him. Emerging from the shadow of the dune, Gabriel saw Nadia for the first time since she had walked past him in the lobby of the Burj al Arab. Cloaked in her death shroud, she appeared paralyzed by fear. So did the sparsely bearded young jihadi who was guarding her. Malik walked over and shoved the boy out of the way. Then he seized Nadia's dark hair and pulled her toward Gabriel.
"Look at what you've done!" he shouted over her screams. "This is what happens when you seduce our people into renouncing their faith." "She never renounced her faith, Malik."
"Let her go."
"She worked for you against us. She has to be punished. And for your sins you shall cast the first stone." "I won't do it."
Gabriel looked searchingly toward the sky. One last deception. One last lie.
"And neither will you, Malik."
Malik smiled. It was genuine.
"This isn't Pakistan or Yemen, Alon. This is Saudi Arabia. And the Americans would never fire a hellfire missile against the territory of their great ally, the House of Saud. Besides, no one knows where you are. You are completely alone." "Are you sure about that, Malik?"
Clearly he wasn't. Still clutching a handful of Nadia's hair, he tilted his face to the sky. So did the others, including al-Kamal. He was standing about 3 feet to Gabriel's left, holding the knife and the camera.
"Listen carefully," Gabriel said. "Can you hear it? It's circling just overhead. It's watching with its cameras. Let her go, Malik. Otherwise we're all going to die in a flash of fire. You'll go to your god. Nadia and I will go to ours."
"There is no god but God, Alon. There is only Allah."
"I hope you're right, Malik, because you're about to see his face. Do you want to be a martyr, or do you prefer to leave the martyrdom to others?"
Malik flung Nadia aside and swung the Kalashnikov wildly toward Gabriel's head. Gabriel easily sidestepped the blow and delivered a vicious knee to Malik's groin that sent him sprawling to the sand. Then Gabriel pivoted with his arms extended and his hands formed like the blade of an axe. The blade connected squarely with Rafik al-Kamal's neck, crushing his larynx. Gabriel looked at Nadia and at the pile of bone-white stones. Then he flailed his arms like a madman against the sky and screamed, "Take the shot! Take the shot! It's Malik, damn it! Take the shot!" Adrian Carter hung up the phone with the White House and buried his face in his hands. Uzinavat watched for a few seconds longer, then closed his eyes. Only Shamron refused to look away. It was his fault, all of it. The least he could do was see it through to the end. Malik had risen to one knee and was groping blindly about for his fallen Kalashnikov. Gabriel was still raging at the merciless sky. He heard the metallic clack-clack of the rifle's cocking handle and saw the barrel rise. Then, from the corner of one eye, he glimpsed the ghost-like flash of Nadia's sparkling white death shroud as she came hurtling toward him. As she passed before the gun, two crimson flowers bloomed violently in the centre of her chest, though her face appeared oddly serene as she collapsed onto Gabriel. Malik tore her away and pointed the Kalashnikov downward at Gabriel's face, but before he could pull the trigger again, the side of his head exploded in a flash of pink. Several more gunshots followed, until only the young jihadi remained standing. He peered down at Gabriel, his face eclipsing the sun, then looked mournfully at Nadia.
"It was God's will that she died today," he said. "But at least she did not suffer." "No," said Gabriel. "She did not suffer." "Are you hit?" asked the boy. "One round," said Gabriel. "Will they come for you?" "Eventually." "Can you hold out until they arrive?" "I think so." "I have to leave you here alone. I have a wife. I have a child on the way." "Boy or girl?"
asked Gabriel, his strength beginning to ebb.
"Girl."
"Have you chosen a name?"
"Hanan."
"Be kind to her," said Gabriel.
"Treat her always with respect."
The boy stepped away. The sun beat upon Gabriel's face. He heard an engine turning over, then glimpsed a cloud of dust moving across the sea of sand. After that, there was only the empty silence of the desert. He waved his arms one final time toward the sky to tell them he was still alive. Then he closed Nadia's eyes and wept against her breast as her body turned slowly to stone. Part 4. The Awakening. 67. Paris, Langley, Riyadh. More than 24 hours would elapse before AAB Holdings finally revealed to the world that its chairwoman and chief executive, Nadia Al-Bakari, was missing and presumed kidnapped. According to a company statement, she had been travelling by limousine at the time of her disappearance, en route from Dubai's famed Burj Al Arab Hotel to the airport. Two calls had been placed from the car, both from the phone of her longtime security chief. During the first, he had instructed the head of AAB's travel department to move up the departure of the company's aircraft by 15 minutes, from 11 p.m. to 10:45. 7 minutes later, he had phoned again to say Miss Al-Bakari was feeling ill and would return to the hotel to spend the night. It was her wish, he said, that the rest of the staff return to Paris as planned. Needless to say, Emirati authorities now regarded the second call as highly suspect, though they had yet to determine whether the security man was part of a conspiracy or merely another victim. The bodyguard was missing. as was the driver of the car. As expected, the news sent shockwaves through already jittery global financial markets. Share prices tumbled in Europe, where AAB's portfolio was vast, and trading on Wall Street opened sharply lower. Hardest hit, though, was Dubai Inc. Having spent untold billions portraying itself as an oasis of stability in a turbulent region, the Emirate now appeared to be a place where even heavily guarded billionaires were not safe. The ruler took to the airwaves to declare his city-state secure and open for business, but investors weren't so sure. They pummeled Dubai-based firms and sovereign wealth funds with a merciless wave of selling that left the city of gold teetering once more on the brink of insolvency. When an additional 24 hours passed with no word of Nadia's fate, the press was left with no option but to speculate wildly on what might have transpired. One theory held that she was murdered by a Russian criminal gang who had lost millions investing in AAB holdings. Another posited that she had offended powerful interests in Dubai with her call for better treatment of the Emirates' migrant labourers. Still another suggested the kidnapping was but a ruse, that Nadia Al-Bukhari, one of the world's richest women, had simply gone into hiding for reasons no one could imagine. Regrettably, it was this final theory that gained the most traction in certain quarters of the press, and before long there was a rash of Nadia sightings at glamorous locations around the globe. The last had her living on a remote island in the Baltic Sea with the son of Sweden's wealthiest man. That report appeared on the same day the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia finally announced that her body had been found in the empty quarter. The bodies of several men had been found with her, according to the Saudis, including that of her security chief. All had been killed by gunfire, as had Miss Al-Bukhari. As of yet, Saudi authorities had no suspects. In keeping with past utterances by the Saudi regime, the statement told only part of the story. It did not say, for example, that Saudi intelligence was already acutely aware of the circumstances surrounding Miss Al-Bukhari's murder. Nor did it mention that a Saudi military patrol had recovered her body within a few hours of her death, along with the only survivor of the incident. Seriously wounded, this survivor was now the subject of intense, if secret, back-channel negotiations between the Central Intelligence Agency and friendly elements of the House of Saud. Thus far, the talks had produced no breakthroughs. In fact, as far as the government of Saudi Arabia was concerned, the man in question did not exist. They promised to mount a search for him, but held out little in the way of hope. The empty quarter, they said, did not treat intruders kindly. Inshallah, they would find his corpse, but only if the Bedouin did not get to him first. The miniature GPS tracking beacon lodged in Gabriel's body told an entirely different story. It was the story of a man who, having been found alive in the empty quarter, had been flown by helicopter to Riyadh and deposited at the sprawling compound run by the Mabahith, the secret police division of the Interior Ministry. A week into his stay, it appeared as though he were taken out for a slow drive across Riyadh to the desert east of the city. For several anxious hours, the staff at Rashidistan feared the worst, that he had been executed and buried in the Wahhabi tradition in a grave with no marker. Eventually, the agency's analysts were able to confirm, with palpable relief, that his new location was in fact Riyadh's main sewage treatment plant. It meant that Gabriel had finally passed the beacon from his intestinal tract. It also meant that he was now off the grid and entirely beyond Langley's reach. The bullet had broken two of Gabriel's ribs and damaged his right lung. The Saudis waited until he was sufficiently recovered before commencing their interrogation. It was conducted by a tall, angular man with a face like a falcon. His olive-drab uniform was starched and pressed, but contained little in the way of insignia. He called himself Khalid. He'd gone to school in England and had the diction of a BBC newsreader. He began by asking for Gabriel's name and a brief description of how he had ended up in the empty quarter, clinging to the corpse of a Saudi woman. Gabriel gave his name as Roland Devereux of Quebec City. He claimed that he had been kidnapped by Islamic extremists while on business in Dubai, that he had been beaten unconscious and driven into the desert to be killed. There had been an argument among the terrorists that led to an exchange of gunfire. He didn't know the nature of the argument, because he spoke no Arabic.
None at all?
I can order coffee.
How do you like it?
Medium sweet. What was the nature...